Yeah. So the way that I'll make it satisfied is I won't talk about anything that Paul's doing. So it's, well, maybe I will. So the title is Phenomenology of Simple Shear Banding. So that gets me out of any of these complicated problems. So Dave asked me to be slightly pedagogical, so I'm going to try to do that. What I want to go through is, first I'll spend some time talking about the analogies between phase diagrams in equilibrium and what we see in the shear banding problem. That is, how can one go between a phase diagram and the flow curves that are observed in a variety of different systems. So I'll spend a little bit of time on a tutorial about how to go from one to the other and what are the different possibilities for flow curves and phase diagrams. And then, interspersed amongst that, I'll talk about examples from calculations. There are very few calculations that actually try to construct a whole phase diagram. Experiments, and I'll spend a little bit of time in specifically talking about vorticity banding, that is where the shear-induced separation or phase transition or whatever you want to call it doesn't occur in the gradient direction but in the vertical direction in a couette device. Okay, there are many complications which seem to render this simple story not irrelevant, but say that most systems, in particular the one like my cells, which have had so much intense interest, may not obey just the simple picture. There are lots of issues about kinetics, which I'll just be able to sort of skate on the top of, and then I'll try to summarize. So the two canonical systems, well, actually the same canonical system, the one like my cells. So this is a gradient, what I call gradient banding, where the phase separation is occurring along the gradient direction. So this is a couette device, and the gradient direction is that way. And you've got a birefringent band near the inner part of the couette device and a non-birefringent band on the outer side of the couette cell. And you get this plateau that we heard about yesterday. And that's the shear thinning, one like my cells. If you play around with the chemistry and the concentration, you can get a plateau going the other way, that is going up in stress. This is from Dave and folks. So, and depending on what you control, and I'll say more about this later, of course, if you control the strain rate, you seem to make a discontinuous jump from one phase to another thick phase, which is a gel-like phase. And if you control the stress, you're able to actually to walk backwards in strain rate as you gradually convert material from a solution to a gel. Okay, and if you look at it, or if Dave and folks look at it, it also seems to be separating in the flow gradient direction. So now we're looking in the side of a couette device, and this is, we're sweeping the stress up. And as you sweep the stress up, this is the interface between the two phases. So that's the vorticity direction, and the flow gradient direction is like that. And there's a gradual conversion as the gel phase sweeps out to fill the cell. So it's also gradient banding. It's a shear thickening gradient banding. And the signature of that is an S-curve like so, rather than an S-curve like so. Okay. So those are the kinds of things we'd like to try to describe. It shows up in a lot of different systems. Francois Molino told us about a micellar solution where the micelles self-assemble, you get into an FCC crystal of various sorts, and as you shear it, you undergo a transition first from a polydomain set of crystals to one particular alignment of the planes, with the micelles organized into planes. Sorry, Tom. And then at a higher stress, the planes organize into a different orientation, and in a couette device, they saw all three of these showing up at the same time. Okay, so that's the motivation for what we want to try to do. Just put the curves up there. So the idea is, so we have these kinds of flow curves. Now, be careful. When I say flow curve, what I actually mean is the steady state curve that you measure if you're prepared to wait long enough. So I would interpret the flow curve to be, in the case of the shear thinning micelles, something where you come up to here, and then you plateau across in at the same stress, or it may be a different stress, the stress may be changing, and then you emerge up along this branch. Of course, how you access this branch will depend on the history of your sample. So it's slightly ambiguous what one means by a flow curve. You've always got to say what your history is in doing the experiment. Similarly, this is the flow curve for the shear thickening micelles, and I've just shown the flow curve you get when you impose a constrained stress, but you get something else when you impose a given strain rate, and it's obvious that you'll get something different if you impose a strain rate, because it's quite difficult to try to get to that point by just controlling the strain rate. Okay, so the history of accessing the flow curve is quite important. Okay, so what can we do to try to understand it? So what kind of phenomenology can we try to use? Okay, so what I want to start with is I'm not going to do anything about deriving models. I want to assume that someone has worked very hard to derive models, or at least we can guess what the models are. And what the models should produce for us is underlying constitutive behavior for different kinds of order of fluids. So this might be a fluid which has initially starts out slightly shear thinning, perhaps as a function of concentration, and maybe you can induce a much more thinning phase, which might be this set of flow curves. So this is obviously motivated by the worm-like micelles, where you can induce a fast-flowing phase. And perhaps there's a gel phase hanging around in the phase diagram as well, which is not stabilized at low strain rates, but is just possibly stabilized at high strain rates or high shear. And then the idea is how do we hook up these curves together to get the macroscopic response? Okay, so you can imagine hooking up these curves like so, hooking up these curves like so, hooking up these curves like so. And that's what I want to go through. Dave?
Hooking up.
So perhaps a point there coexists with a point over there on which you measure an experiment is this particular flow curve. Or perhaps that's not possible in this system, and a point here coexists with a point up there, and you measure this as the flow curve in your experiment. So how does one come up with those kinds of conditions? Okay. So the first point is always to identify the variables in the problem from which these flow curves will arise. There will typically be a concentration variable. There will be obviously a stress and a Navier-Stokes equation, where the stress depends on the other important variables in the problem. And generally there are microstructural variables which tell you about the kind of order you're inducing. So this could be a pneumatic parameter. It could be something to do with the length of the worm-like micelles. It could be something that tells you about the size of onions. But the assumption is that we have an underlying set of equations of motion whose steady states, homogeneous states, give us this variety of flow curves. And there are a number of models out there which will reproduce this kind of thing. Pardon? You don't understand the first one. Why? Yeah, so I should make that a DT. Right. And there will be couplings in there which have to do with flow. Yeah. And in particular, this is the simplest one that one would write down. If phi had to do with, say, the fraction of a particular kind of micelle, particular length, you would have reaction terms in addition to the diffusion terms. Okay. So the tough part is writing this down, and I'm not going to do any of that. Okay, so if we assume that we can solve that set of equations and generate a set of flow curves, let's imagine that we've generated this simple set of flow curves. So we have one branch, which is the quiescent phase, and we've induced a shear thinning branch, which would go to a very much higher shear rate. And we ask about obtaining a coexisting stress at which the two states can quite happily coexist with each other. So what are the conditions for that? Okay, so we say we've got one fraction of the material phase one over here on this part of the system, phase two, this part of the system. In steady state, so we've satisfied all the steady state equations for the other variables, so we're just going to focus on the stress. Divergence of the stress is zero, which says that the shear stress components have to be the same, equal to some selected value. There's obviously no shear in the ZY direction, or the ZY. You have to say Z in this country. This is a very slip, I'm sorry. There's no shear in the ZY direction because I'm not shearing it like that. So this I don't need to worry about.
Excuse me, is it set in England and C here? Or?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So I have.
Remember your roots.
I have a lot of trouble when I. I'm very embarrassed by that. Right. This is beaming out to a worldwide audience, remember? Yeah, if I say Z to undergraduates, they don't understand. Seriously. Anyway, the normal stress component takes care of itself due to the pressure, and you can ask about whether that's going to make the menisci bulge at the top of the cell, and perhaps that will. So all we have is the condition on the shear stress, but that's not enough, because if we have a range of stresses at which the flow curves coexist, there's a whole range of shear stresses. So you need something else. Okay. So rather than try to... Okay, one thing that people have suggested is let's invent a free energy and minimize it. Okay, we're not going to do that. We're just going to work with the equations we have. And the natural thing to put in is what we've left out, which is the information about the interface. That is, the interface is going to carry some different amount of stress due to the fact that we don't have a mathematically sharp interface. Typically, things are changing smoothly in space. Okay. So the simplest thing to do is to take the constitutive relations, which are the constitutive relations for homogeneous states, and modify them by whatever gradient effects we think are in the system. So gradients will drive diffusion, gradients will drive, inhomogeneities will drive stresses. Okay, so generally we have in the region of the interface a contribution to the stress. Here I've written it as if it depends on the gradients of the strain rate, but it may depend on the gradients of the other microscopic variables. Okay, and this turns the algebraic equation into a differential equation, and the differential equation has to obey various boundary conditions. In particular, it has to obey the boundary conditions that on the far side, far away from the interface, you have to lie on the flow curve. And also, if you're far from the interface, all the gradients are zero, so you have a very step profile. Okay, and that actually overdetermines the differential equation, and it will be soluble at a unique value of the stress, generally, or isolated values of the stress. Okay, so this is actually enough to provide a unique value of the stress, which is what's needed because experiments tell us you get a unique value of the stress. You might argue that, well, that's fine and dandy for worm-like micelles where one believes you have a smooth progression between the shear-induced phase and the quiescent phase. One is just a more aligned version of the other, notwithstanding Paul Callahan's experiments. But they're roughly the same, and you can imagine smooth profile between the two. If one is looking at, say, coexistence between lamellae down here and, say, shear-induced onions up there, there's no reason to expect smooth gradients between the interface. So you expect to have a sharp interface. And if you have a sharp interface, what you might expect is that everywhere away from the interface, you have a constitutive relation given by the homogeneous part of the flow curve, and then you have some jump with an interfacial stress, which depends on the properties in the region of that interface. So instead of solving a differential equation, you've got algebraic equations with an additional condition on the interfacial stress. Okay, and this will also resolve this conundrum and give you a selected stress.
Is that like putting a third phase? Are you saying that
It's like postulating that at the interface you have a separate constitutive relation, which could be a third phase. Yeah.
Yeah. That ends up giving you enough equations.
And it'll give you another equation.
But actually, not quite because of what you say. The point is, it has to know about what's going on in the next door phase.
It has to know what's going on in the next door phase.
Well, does it know only because the stresses have to match, or is it knowing some of the
more than that?
The shear stresses have to match. Yeah.
Is that sufficient?
If you know what this constitutive relation is, then it will be sufficient. But the point is that this constitutive relation has to depend on the properties of the whatever the microstructure is in these two phases. So, for example, if it depended on onions, you might expect that this depends on the size of the onion. Just telling you, if you've got a sort of a lumpy interface because you've got onions of a given size, and you've got lamellae going past it, you can make up estimates for how that interfacial stress will depend on the size of the onions.
So if I stuck in a third phase whose stress depended only on, if I literally stuck in a third phase and rose in a positional relationship,
then it wouldn't be enough. Then you'd have a whole other third phase with another order parameter. Yeah. So both of these extremes could, in principle, be cast in terms of an equation of motion, in terms of a description, not in terms of the bulk phases, but in terms of what's going on at the interface. Because in fact, if you have a stable steady state, that means that the interface has stopped moving. So if you have an equation of motion for an interface, this is proposed by Armand Ajdari, taken up by Jacqueline and Dave to look at the shear thickening micelles. If you have an equation of motion for this interface, and you set that equation of motion equal to zero, that will give you the conditions for a stable interface. And you could, in principle, and we've started to do this, you can derive an equation of motion for the interface from smooth differential equation. So this has been the domain of people doing pattern formation for quite a long time. So you can actually go from one to the other.
Expression down there is some sort of a phenomenological solution to the right? I mean, that's just a way of dealing with it.
This is saying if the interfaces become quite sharp, you're no longer allowed to use gradient expansion because you've got really sharp profiles. So we're just going to, and so you really would need to use many gradients. And so we're going to subsume all that stuff to have an interfacial stress.
Peter, does the next constitutive relation need to depend on gamma dot, or is a bare interfacial tension will be enough?
A bare interfacial tension could be enough. No, that won't be enough because the area of the interface doesn't change. Yeah. So it needs to know about the material properties on either side of the interface.
I mean, don't you need something like let's say a friction coefficient between?
You could do it that way. Yeah. So you could. This is the kind of things we've been playing with. It's you put a friction coefficient between the two phases, with a magnitude. It depends on the nature of the two phases. So if you had onions, you would have a friction coefficient that depends on the size of the onions, and you would need an equation of motion for the size of the onions as a function of shear rate. And you could work that out, for example. Yep. This is wide open at the moment. We've just done the simplest thing. But pardon?
I'm still lost about the relative roles of A, B, and C. So
right.
So A is a description that's self-sufficient if you have a smooth interface and you can have a gradient description.
And you have a gradient description, yeah. So that's the simplest case, yeah.
Right.
You can, from here.
A sharp interface, I would want to use the last condition.
Yep.
And what's the intermediate thing?
So both of these are descriptions of the bulk properties.
Should be A1 and A2.
Yeah, these should be A1 and A2, in fact. And This is a completely alternative description where you effectively integrate out the bulk properties and you just focus on what's happening to the interface itself. So you try to drive an equation of motion for the interface.
But you would do that from A.
You can do it from A. You could, I suppose you could do it from B, although.
You don't need A other than to derive B, basically, in some sense. In other words, once you decide you're going to do B.
Yeah, so the stuff that Armand did and Jacqueline and Dave, they just wrote down B. And you can do that as well. But what you need is you need an additional condition somehow. Okay, so once we have that, let me just say a little word about why this is different from calculating phase coexistence in equilibrium. Obviously, it's different. In equilibrium, what would you do? You would have a phase-separated system or a phase transition and you would minimize the total free energy of your system, and you would neglect the interfacial free energy because it just vanishes in the thermodynamic limit. Now, the point about a driven system in this sheared system is we're applying forces at the boundary, so we're putting work into the system, so we're constantly dumping energy into it. When we reach a steady state, there's going to have to be a flux of heat coming out of it because we're generating heat and it's going to be coming out. So in particular, that means you've got dissipation and whatnot passing through the interface. So the interfacial boundary condition is actually crucial because it's controlling the ability to obtain a steady state. Okay, so it's entirely believable that the properties of the interface are quite important, and you can't have a free energy an out of equilibrium free energy functional with which you ignore the properties of the interface. That's the conceptual point. And I don't want to say too much about how you solve for the selection. You can, in the case of a different set of differential equations, you can map this onto a dynamical system, and you can play fancy games with looking for heteroclinic orbits in a dynamical system. So if you don't know about that, don't worry about it. If you know about it, it's really quite fun to play with. But what you find is, so in particular, there's a natural question, is there an equal areas construction? Does the selected stress give you an equal areas construction? And the answer is, well, sometimes. It actually depends on the nature of the gradient terms. If you have a very simple set of gradient terms, maybe you'll get an equal areas construction. If there was a prefactor in front of the gradient terms which depended on some local order parameter, you get something completely different. So the phase coexistence criteria depends on the nature of the interface. Whereas in equilibrium, you could actually do the same procedure in equilibrium, but you would find that the equations are integrable exactly, and everything can be done in terms of equations of motion, in terms of constancy of the equation of motion, independent of the interface, because it's the Hamiltonian system. Okay. There is an analog of a Gibbs phase rule, just because we have numbers of components and we have constraints. So you can derive the analog of a Gibbs phase rule for this as well. Okay, so let's put that into practice and see what the different possibilities are. Okay, so start with the most looked at case, which is this geometry up here. So this is the worm-like micelles, where you've got a phase which shows up at the inner part of the couette, and you've got the same stress in the two phases. Okay, and I'm going to go through on the left when there's no concentration difference between the two phases, and we're going to go through on the right when there is a concentration difference. Okay, and actually, people by Schmidt, Marquez, and Lecoe was the first people to point this out, the fact that I'm going to get to down here. Okay, so if we maintain that at a given selected stress, two phases coexist, then say we have a given concentration, there's going to be one stress at which phase A coexists with phase B. Right. Now, if we change the concentration, there'll be a different stress, generally. So if there's no biphasic regime, you'll just have a line in the stress composition plane, and that will tell you where phase coexistence occurs. You can look at that information in the gamma dot concentration plane, and there are tie lines in this plane which connect the states at the same stress but different strain rates. So if it's a shear thinning fluid, you come up, and then you coexist with the material which is going faster, which is up here, and it's at the same concentration, so the tie line is vertical. Okay, so I can cast the phase diagram in this plane or in this plane. In this plane, the stress is the field variable. In this plane, I have it as gamma dot, which is an analog of a density variable in equilibrium. And you can get the flow curve from this phase diagram, because what happens is you go up and you stay at the same stress until you emerge into the second phase. So you come up, you stay at the same stress, you go through the two phase region, so you have a flat plateau, and then you come out into the second phase. Right.
For that, you need something like stick boundary conditions between the two phases, right?
Why? The boundary conditions are all in the gradient terms.
They have to really
hold on to each other because you have to distribute the relative displacement between the two faces, and that's what gives you that kind of a level.
Right. So if you're sitting in the middle, you've got to have the same overall strain rate. So you'll have a fraction of material over on this face and a fraction over there. And as you move across the plateau, the interface between the phases will move from one side of the system to the other side of the system to satisfy the Lever rule. That's right. Yeah.
But there's no discontinuity in the loss on the interface.
I'm never considering a discontinuity in velocity, unless we go to a sharp interface case where then you would put it in explicitly as your slip. Yep.
Is it gamma dot or is it gamma that's the strain rate?
Gamma dot is the strain rate.
Okay, because you said gamma on the previous slide.
Did I?
No, it's fine. It just didn't make any sense that it was gamma.
No, it doesn't make any sense to be gamma. So it's should I open? I'll have some slides later which probably say gamma. It should always say gamma dot in this talk. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, now the other case would be where, which is probably the more likely case in a solution, where when the two states phase separate under shear, they have different concentrations. There's no reason to believe they have the same concentration. And generally, when something can take advantage of another degree of freedom, it will do so. Okay, so generally, you expect to have a biphasic regime with a small window of concentrations. Okay, so now what will happen is you have tie lines in the stress composition plane. In the gamma dot concentration plane, instead of being vertical, they're tilted because the system will coexist with a phase which has to be at a higher concentration so that it has to be tilted to the right. So it'll be tilted like so. And now you can see that if you move through the two-phase region, you come up, and then as you go through the two-phase region at the same concentration, you know, satisfying the Lever rule everywhere, so now you have a Lever rule in concentration and strain rate, the stress will increase through the two-phase region. And so you'll end up with some kind of a slope in your plateau. So you no longer have a flat plateau, but you have a slope whose shape depends on what's going on with these tie lines. There's no particular reason it even needs to be flat. It could be doing something weird. Doesn't even have to, no. Could be, in fact, so some experiments on worms have measured the slope of sigma going as gamma dot to the 0.1 or 0.2 power. Nice and flat on a log-log plot. So there are no rules, in fact, about what it needs to be. Okay. So. Yes.
Depending whether you conforms the apparently whether you conform the shear rate of the stress.
Yep.
On the left, I can imagine what would happen. Either you describe the plateau or you jump as a function of time from one branch to the other.
Yeah. So if you
on the right side, what will happen?
You know, on this side.
Yeah, depending whether you conform the stress or the shear.
So again, we assume that there's an underlying flow curve, which is sort of continuing up like that, continuing
yes.
down like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you control the stress, say.
Yes.
Okay. So you come up to there. And now the question that you're asking is, do you jump to there and jump to abandoned state?
Yes.
Or do you jump to there? I have no idea, and we need experiments to test this kind of thing. It seems to be in the worm-like micelles that quite frequently, when you control the stress, you can actually access this plateau. And that actually makes sense because in a couette device, you'll have a high shear, high stress near the inner cylinder and a low stress near the outer cylinder. So you would naturally start to nucleate something in the inside, and you would imagine that the band would travel across until it got to the right point and filled up the sample, and then it would stop. But if you had something that didn't have that kind of inhomogeneity, you'd be forced to wait for a nucleation event. And then it's a question of whether the nucleation event causes it to jump all the way over or just to this point.
Why wouldn't you give a firm answer that you're running out of shear banded point? That's like the band doesn't move until we reach the stationary state where it has stationary velocity.
Right, because if let's say my underlying flow curve did that. So it had an unstable bit. So now I might imagine that, let me not draw on the screen. That if I start there, that a nucleation event could occur in some way that we don't understand, and then the band could form at the inner cylinder and then travel to there. Right. But now imagine increasing the stress to this point up here, where the system is unstable. So the instability, if it's unstable enough, it could go unstable everywhere, and then it could end up. Yeah, I guess I would find it hard to, same dilemma, yeah. Don't know where it would go. So.
But I think the point is that what you calculate is the manifold of allowable valid states.
Exactly right.
And there's still the homogeneous states there, which may be metastable, or they may even be stable. And then maybe it could be tri-stable. The system could have perfectly well-defined, infinitely long-lived steady state, three different states there, but only one of which is banded.
Yep.
And so there's a unique construction of the banded piece of this curve, but then what the system actually chooses to do is a slightly different question.
Yeah, I mean, so one could calculate these, but there are no other rules about which one is.
Is it true that one of the two homogeneous states is unstable in the sense that if you put a small layer of the other phase against it, that if you did insert it in an interface, then it would move away from the wall?
I think it depends on the system.
The reason I thought that is that you've identified a particular stress at which the interface velocity vanishes, so I might think that the interface velocity will anything, that one of those two homogeneous states has to be unstable.
Yeah, so if you've got the strain rate, say, here, and you prepare. So you impose the strain rate there, and you ramp the system up so it's all in this quasi-metastable state. And now you nucleate a little bit of that band along the wall. You can show it for a particular model that we've done for the Johnson-Segman model, which is a particular rheological model, that if you have a curved flow, that once you nucleate a band near the wall, then it will start to move, and then the rest, the phase transformation will occur. If you formed a band and it was flat, I don't know whether it would go this way or whether it would go that way. In fact, generally, I think it would stay put. No, it wouldn't stay put. It would move one way or the other.
One thing that you have to have
It won't stay still, but I don't know whether it would move in the direction to perform the phase conversion or to reduce the band. And that would be model dependent. And probably depends on the inhomogeneity of the flow, because any typical flow has got a slight gradient to it.
Well, I guess I could do get confused with the concentration.
We should.
In the simple case on the left, if the velocity of the interface depends monotonically on the stress.
Generally it does, yeah.
And if you've identified one stress at which it vanishes, that kind of sounds like it's sufficient to say that one of those two phases is always unstable.
To an infinitely thin layer
of the other one. Yeah.
Which is basically the same criteria you have for bandwidth. It's unstable for growth in nucleus.
Yeah. Well, in one dimension.
If I'm there, and I form a small interface, so I'm here, I form a small interface which is at the wrong stress. Okay, now that thing is going to move. I don't know whether it's going to move this way or whether it's going to move the other way. It will do that if you've got a curved flow, because if you've got curved flow, then the stress is inhomogeneous.
I think you showed that even in the box.
Did he?
Yeah, if the stress is above the selected value, then it moves or shifts to the high shear up. I'm pretty sure I'm going
to. Okay. Then it does.
We've got behavior where by going to sufficiently high stress, you get what looks like nucleation throughout the gap. that then just grows.
Yeah. So if you go to a sufficiently high stress where the whole thing is unstable, then you might get the analog of spinodal decomposition, where it's.
I mean, this isn't quite. Yeah. Okay. The thing is that you may be right in that if you have a nucleated a layer of the other phase, it will always take you across if you're above, and it will always take you back
yeah.
if you're below.
No, I think that's exactly
but
right. Yeah.
What we do know is that at least one system for one like micelles, you go up towards that dot which he's drawn there, and the time to nucleate diverges. So it won't happen. It is truly metastable.
But it becomes metastable when you get close to here.
Yeah, in other words, there's a dot below which the nucleation time, you can get onto the metastable branch above the point A plus B. And as you come down, the nucleation time smoothly blows up. And below that, it's infinite as far as can be measured on the time scale of a week. So it just depends perhaps on what you mean by stable, metastable. Yeah.
Oh. Anyway. Okay, so it's the first phase diagram. Okay. Okay, so that was coexistence at a common strain rate. Now, there is the possibility, and I'll talk about this in a little more detail in a bit, that instead of having the strain rate be different in two phases with the stress the same, you could have the shear rate be the same in the two phases, but have the gradient occur in the vorticity direction so that the stresses are different. Okay, this is actually allowable. Okay, now obviously to get this kind of situation, you've got to have overlaps like so in the flow curve. So you could jump from one branch down to another, or if you had a flow curve coming from above, you could jump from one curve up to the other. Okay, now this is a case where the strain rate is the same because it's homogeneous across the gap, but the stress is different. So now the analog of a thermodynamic field variable is now strain rate, and the analog of a density variable is a stress. So they swap identity depending on what the geometry is. And we know that in thermodynamics, one is extensive and one is intensive, but here both of them are intensive. So that kind of makes sense that it should just depend on geometry. Okay, so let's look at an example of that. This would be shear thickening. And on the left-hand side, I have the case where there's no concentration difference. So here, no concentration difference. There's my little symbol, great vorticity direction. So that means the strain rate is the same. So if there's no concentration difference, it's just a line in the strain rate concentration plane. If it's shear thickening, it makes a jump to a state which is a larger stress, a vertical tie line. So the flow curve that you would get would go up. Something like that. And again, there would be generally, perhaps this comes across and this will come back. Instead of a selected stress, you can do the same construction as before, but now there's a selected strain rate. And you can ask exactly the same questions about hysteresis that you just asked for the other one. And again, there are all sorts of things could happen. If you change the concentration between the two phases, so we take that and we just explode that a little bit. So you come up and you're going to coexist with a phase which in this case has a lower concentration, higher stress, which means tie lines are drawn like so. They have a slope. And as you move through the two-phase region, the strain rate increases. It doesn't stay constant. And so you have a slope which looks something like that, generally. And now you notice that I've got a slope, a vertical slope, a positive slope here, and I've got a positive slope there. And so seeing a plateau with a slight slope is not indicative of whether you've got vorticity banding or gradient banding. You've got to actually look to see which is which. What it does mean in both cases is that you've got different concentrations between the two phases, between one and the other, which then would tell you that probably you've got really slow kinetics going on, and you've got to wait a really long time to make sure that it's settled down.
Both of these two sets of phase diagrams, you've taken a common choice of behavior of the coexistence stresses with five, but not a
anti-general one.
What do you mean?
So things could be otherwise. So the slopes might be negative.
No, they won't.
Never.
No, well, they will be, and I'll come to that in a second, yes. So sorry. I said, yeah, would it?
Yeah. The final slopes, because you've made an arbitrary but general choice in the physics of the coexistence.
Yep.
Which answer should we believe?
No.
There will be
this way, sorry. Tom was jumping my thunder, but yes. So I'm considering shear thickening.
Yeah. These,
but shear thinning will be the next choice.
Has anybody seen this vorticity banding?
Yep, I'll come to that. Yeah.
But if those timelines look like you've drawn them, the slope is positive.
If they look like I've drawn them, the slope will be positive. That's right. Now, you could draw them the other way, which I'll do in the next transparency.
You don't have the sense of curvature in the vorticity.
Precisely. So that will be the kinetics in vorticity banding in the Couette cell will be very interesting. Extremely slow and very messy. Yeah. Yep.
And what's the length scale?
No idea. No idea. Absolutely no idea. Well, if you had a system which had a set of flow curves that looked like this, so you turn off the flow and the quiescent state becomes unstable due to something. Okay, but there's another branch hiding up there which can be stabilized. And the only way they can overlap is at a common strain rate. Then if you force the stress to lie in this middle region, there are two things that could happen. One is you get macroscopically separated state with regions of one stress, regions of another stress, or you get some time-dependent state. So I'm only considering the case of macroscopically separated state, but there will be time-dependent states like Taylor-Couette, or things analogous to Taylor-Couette, where you get things flipping back and forth between different states. And that kind of thing has been seen in worm-like micelles.
But if the system's set up multiple interfaces, it would take a long time to figure out that was a bad idea.
It will, yeah, because it... Right,
there's nothing to push it one way or the other.
Yeah, in fact, you can show that the...
Probably tiny forces between interfaces.
Right, so since you guys are jumping ahead.
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay, so if you get vorticity banding, you might expect if you push it into the unstable region, so maybe you have a flow curve like so. We impose a stress here, so it pushes it up into the unstable region. It goes unstable, and you nucleate a bunch of bands. Now, how will these bands coarsen? This is essentially a one-dimensional coarsening problem. And if you describe the problem by a smooth gradient system, you can show that the time scale of the coarsening is exponential in the coefficient in front of the gradient terms. And so this is basically going to take a very long time to settle down. And so whereas in the gradient banding in the Couette device, you see macroscopic chunks. The reason for that is you've got accelerated coarsening because the curvature is driving the interfaces one way or the other. Whereas in this case, there's nothing to
If you do have concentration difference, then there's gravity.
If you have concentration difference, there will be gravity. And
if you have experiments, that might be fine, because you know, a few percent difference of concentration, the phases sort themselves out statically in a few minutes.
Yeah. So an example where this kind of thing has been seen in, I don't know if you believe that this is an example of vorticity banding. So this is a colloidal suspension.
It's holding you.
Okay. So this is a colloidal suspension which undergoes a transition from a sort of a polydisperse phase to a shear-lined, essentially crystalline phase, or with macroscopic crystals. And you can see that inhomogeneities are occurring along the vorticity direction.
Inhomogeneities in what? And this is a stress band. We've got to measure stress bands. So
these are stress bands, yeah.
Why are they stress bands? What are we seeing here?
Okay. And so the stuff that's sort of milky white has been interpreted by the authors as very small crystals, polycrystal phase, similar to Francois Molino's BC, is he here? There he is. BCC micelles, which give you very small polycrystals. Then this sort of shimmering sheen has been interpreted by them, and they've done light scattering, so you can see hexagonal ordering, nice regular planes that are sort of macroscopic.
Is it structure bending, but is that stress bending?
Oh, yeah. Okay, if you look at the flow curve, Dave says, oh, yeah.
I mean, a liquid and a crystal can't possibly have this any similar reality
Paul,
at all.
So here's the flow curve that they get.
Is this Sikorsky and Akerson?
Yes. Yeah. So here's their flow curve. They come up, and the stress decreases. And so what they're doing is they go from this polycrystal to well-aligned planes, which have a lower effective viscosity. The stress comes down, and this is what they see. So if they go up, it comes down. If they come back, it goes the other way. Right. And so
it's just the kind of structure seen in these simulations.
Exactly. Yeah, it's been seen recently in, or maybe not so recently.
This is probably a silly question, but
nope.
If I take something like a Couette device and I put some viscoelastic material in it, there are essentially hydrodynamic instabilities that
look like this. Yeah.
Could have link scales that are relevant. I mean, in other words, it's...
Yeah. So if you did something like that, where you get sort of viscoelastic Taylor Couette or whatever, they'll typically in those there's a well-defined length scale. Because it circulates around. Yeah. So if you see a well-defined length scale that's absolutely regular, that might be suggestive that there's something else going on. I don't actually know. But that's an important point.
I just mentioned that when you make hexagonal crystals, for example, you get this kind of curve that is Chevenin's gradient error.
I don't think it is. You mean this one? So this one you claim is banding in the gradient direction.
Yeah.
Ah, now this is issue. Okay, the point is because of this slow coarsening effect. Unless there's a big density difference between the phases, if you get a bunch of bands, they're going to sit there. So if your measuring device is small enough, so that you can distinguish between there and there and there, then I completely agree. But using what?
Using X-ray.
Right. Your X-ray has a beam diameter of. Right, and so if it's 2 millimeters, you're covering a whole. Right. Okay. So the.
You can.
Yep, that's right. So if the bands have a size of larger than 100 microns, then you would expect to see it. But if they have a size that's smaller than 100 microns, then you wouldn't expect to see it. Pardon?
We see bounding in the other direction.
Do you? I'm not. Well, we need to talk about that, but I'm not. Yes. So.
Why were you skeptical that it was banding in the other direction?
Because of this curve. Which is what I'll come on to is, I challenge someone to construct a picture with a simple phase diagram like I'm showing you, which will come up with this picture with banding in the gradient direction. So I've spent about a week trying all different phase diagrams, and I can't come up with one with banding in the gradient direction, which gives me this kind of curve. Now if this is a metastable curve, and really there should be a plateau coming across there, then... So.
So.
I'm sure you have, yeah. So. Didier.
Yeah, in our case, when we go through the transition between the Onion state and the oriented state, we do have exactly that, which is we have a plateau.
Mm-hmm.
We can go a little bit fast and have something like this hysteresis loop, which is not a pure hysteresis. If you wait long enough, you don't have it. But if we wait long enough, we don't have it. But we do have, in the vorticity direction, bands. And in our case, it's very nice because we can stop the
Let me go back and finish my pedagogy, my trawl through the different phase diagrams. But this one is an anomaly, and So where do we get? We got to shear thickening with banding in the vorticity direction. Okay, so now let's do shear thinning with banding in the vorticity direction. Okay, so there's my vorticity band. No concentration, then what do? You actually, in the stress plane, you go all the way up to this stress, and then you coexist with a state which has a lower stress. So you have to think of this as being a surface, and you're sort of climbing up this surface, and then it's coexisting with some the lower stress down below, and then it comes out above. Okay, so you come up this way, and then you go down through, and you go up on the next Riemann sheet up above, so to speak. Okay, which means that the stress goes up, down, and then up. Okay, so this would be the sort of the ideal case if there's no concentration difference between the two phases. All right. Thank you. Those were the so those are dots. Yeah. Okay. So now, when you put concentration in, it gets a little more fun. Okay. So let's start in the middle. So now what we've taken was we've taken the thin line, which had no concentration difference, and we've exploded it to allow there to be a concentration difference. Okay? And I've just chosen arbitrarily that when you go up, when you increase the shear rate, you coexist with something at a lower concentration. You could flip these around and construct analogous ones the other way. So what does that mean? So in this particular, in the left-hand side, if I come up in shear rate, I enter the two-phase region. Shear thinning means what you might think is shear thinning. You coexist with a phase which has a lower stress. So there it is down there, lower stress, smaller concentration variable, so the tie line has a negative slope. All right? Now, what would the flow curve be that you'd find if you came through here? You come up into the two-phase region. These are increasing. This is increasing the strain rate as I move up here. So the strain rate increases, and the stress increases. So I have a positive slope. Let me just put. So that's a positive slope. Right? We had shear thinning, which also gave us a positive slope. There's a concentration difference. Here, the reason we have a positive slope is that because we have a huge concentration difference. Okay. Now, let's look at a different kind of curve we could have, which is this one over here. So now I come up, I increase the strain rate, and then it coexists, say the blue one, it coexists with the material at a lower stress, just like this case, and a lower concentration, so it's over to the left, but it's a lot steeper. Okay? And it's steep enough that I've taken this sort of ribbon here and I've just twisted it around, but the topology of the tie lines is exactly the same. That means I've got a negative slope here, and I've got a negative slope, it's just a little bit closer to vertical. Okay? Now, as I go through the two-phase region, what I will do, remember what happened in the previous transparency, you go different color, I come up, I enter the two-phase region, then I come down, and then I go back out. Okay, so in this case, when I increase the strain rate, that is, I move from one tie line to the next, the stress decreases. Okay, so now I have a negative slope, going through the two-phase region rather than a positive slope. And the reason is that in this case, it's shear thinning, but I have a very weak concentration difference between the two phases. Here, it's shear thinning, but I have a massive concentration difference. And it's whether it's big enough to sort of flip this phase diagram around. Think about it being a ribbon. And we didn't guess this. I didn't guess this. This came out of a calculation. I didn't believe it for the liquid crystals. But it actually is there.
At which point is the slope zero or is...
There will be right around in here. So actually, if you start down here...
The entire line is parallel to the dotted grid line.
Exactly. Yeah. When you start down here, the slope will be positive. When you start over here, the slope will be negative. So we did. So this actually came out first.
Could it change sign halfway along?
Which change sign?
In a given flow curve, can it change from positive to negative slope halfway through?
Oh yeah. So you can invent all sorts of things. So here's a common stress one, where over at this concentration, this is phi one. I've got something which will be coming backwards because it's basically a shear thickening case. Over here, it's a shear, more like a shear thinning case, and in between, you've actually got both things sort of happening at once. Or here, it can go up and it can go down. This is a common strain rate one. Basically, anything is possible. And this is all within just two phases. As soon as you try to add three phases, which seems to be happening in the worms, we need someone a lot stronger than I to try to calculate the different possibilities.
With two phases, you're only in two bands.
Two bands between two distinct phases. Because if you had three, you could imagine triple points. You could put this kind of thing in. Right.
You know, I just want to be clear what the difference between thinning in the electricity direction and thickening in the electricity direction. If I make this simple, even with low concentration between them, it seems to be that the sets of graphs look exactly the same.
So, the difference is here.
Yeah, the difference is there, but the top two graphs.
The top two are different. And the reason they're different is because the solid line, I didn't say this, the solid line is where you enter the two-phase region. So here you enter it at a high stress, so this will be the shear thinning one. And here you enter it at a low stress, and that'll be the shear thickening one.
Thank you.
So, let me just summarize this bit.
Well, then you're looking at nice two-dimensional sheets of phi,
yeah, in fact,
stress, and gamma dot. So that makes the problem work.
Yeah. Right, so. Right, so the best thing to do for a particular model is to calculate the locus of points for stress, concentration, and strain rate. Now, if you have gradient banding, you want to slice through this with a common stress, and you want to ask about, say, this point coexisting with that point. If it's got a little fold, now you can slice through it at a given strain rate. You come down from above, and you could find, say, that phase coexisting with that phase. And so if you actually look at the whole three-dimensional surface, you can isolate all the different possibilities in a much easier way.
How do you decide which phase is coexisting with which?
Okay, so the way what you need to do is take all the possibilities that there are. Okay, so in this particular case, so this was a liquid crystal model. We actually had three phases. We had the isotropic branch, the pneumatic branch, and there was another surface over here, which was log rolling. So there was another flow branch sort of over there. And so log rolling is where, so you're shearing it, and the director's in the plane. So these two cases, the director's in the plane, either at sort of close to 45 degrees when it's isotropic, or fairly well aligned when it's pneumatic. Log rolling is where it sticks up like that.
In the vorticity.
In the vorticity. Yeah. It's like lamellae flipping up or flipping down in shear. Okay, so the DOI model supports log rolling. And what you need to do is you need to just look at all the possibilities, calculate which ones are possible. The problem is, once you've done that, you don't know what to do. Okay, so for the liquid crystal model, we can calculate this kind of thing. There are three phases floating around. And in common stress phase separation, you can have the weakly isotropic one coexisting with a strongly aligned pneumatic one. You can get the isotropic one coexisting with the log rolling one.
Okay, excuse me. In this case, it's what?
Rods in a solvent, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can calculate log rolling pneumatic, and that actually sort of occurs over here, a little sliver. But beyond that, you don't know which one is preferred. Although you might imagine that this you could prepare and it would be metastable, because this isotropic phase is sort of sitting in the pneumatic part of the phase diagram.
You missed something.
Did I? Yeah.
Well, everything you talked about up to now was calculating the manifold of allowed standard states. And there can be pieces which look like valid, pieces which look like this.
Yeah.
And maybe connecting different states which have more than two.
Yeah.
But now you're telling me you have a way of knowing that those different banded states is preferred.
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, so then what were you just saying about this?
I was speculating. Oh. Okay. So. This is an allowed banded. this is an allowed banded state between isotropic and log rolling.
Yeah, that's all you know.
That's all I know, and I know that.
One as well, which is also allowed.
And this is allowed.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea.
Which decides.
If you would put the system right here.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether it would go to one or the other.
You do know if you're close that in equilibrium, one of the two banded states in that limit isn't allowed.
They're identical in equilibrium. They're just different orientations of the director.
Question about realizing this experimentally. Your earlier comment was speculation. Is that if you start from a quiescent state at that concentration, it would be fully pneumatic, and so you would have to, under shear, nucleate and grow isotropic under a condition where it would not form, and that's why your preference is for.
Yeah. So well, if you started here, say. In the isotropic. Now you turn up stress. Mm-hmm. This dotted line is the limit of stability for the isotropic phase under shear. Okay, so you could turn up the stress and you could in principle, you're right. I'd need to start here in the biphasic region. So in this case, it's going to be quite difficult unless you could arrange a biphasic regime where you say you do a surface prep, so you're in the log rolling state in the Couette device. And so you start with a macroscopically phase separated with a liquid crystal in the right orientation, and then start shearing it, and then you ask whether it becomes unstable to this phase separation. That would be fun to do. The problem with the liquid crystal model is that because it's either a problem or a feature, depending on your point of view, I consider it a feature. Where did my surface go? Right. So these are flow curves calculated from the liquid crystal case, and you've got both common strain rate, common strain rate, vorticity, and gradient banding, and so you can calculate both phase diagrams, and there they are. There's the common stress banding one, and you get a set of flow curves. And you can calculate the common strain rate banding one for separating along the vorticity direction, and it has a set of flow curves. And we have absolutely no idea of knowing which one is preferred over the other. In equilibrium, you have to appeal to things like the geometry and the behavior of fluctuations and start looking at those, I think. Although you might argue that if you put it in a Couette device, this one will be preferred because this has the symmetry of a Couette device. But I can't say any more than that. Okay, so we can summarize. Okay, so there's common stress, common strain rate. They can either be shear thinning or shear thickening. You have either horizontal or vertical lines depending on, well, it's either horizontal or vertical if you have no difference in a conserved variable between the two phases. If you have a conserved variable that changes, then you generally will have a slope between of some sort. Now let me just reminded of something that Didier asked. Right. Go back to the onion case. So this curve was the curve where there's a very little concentration difference between the two phases. If you have a big concentration difference, you might expect it to become more sloped or flatter. So that would mean that if it likes to phase separate, I'm sorry, if it likes to have a concentration difference between the two phases, it'll take time for that to happen. So you might imagine, I think this may be occurring, that if you do a fairly rapid sweep, you could measure this kind of curve because it separates into the two macroscopic phases, say onion and lamellae, and then it's waiting a long time for concentration to change. But if you do a very slow sweep, that is, you just sit here, then you'll gradually change the concentration between the two, and this will rotate up to do something like that. So the issue of having a concentration difference actually can be very tricky, because depending on the time scale which you look at it, you might have completely different interpretations. So, and I think that may be going on in some of these systems. So most of these, but I put hexagonal micelles there. I know Francois doesn't like that. We can talk about that. But you notice that so this
cells in hexagonal order.
Yeah. Yes, hexagonally ordered micelles, exactly. You notice that in all this, you notice that what's very important is I've always plotted the stress here. So this is going to be my plea. This is my crusade. Please plot the stress. Viscosity doesn't tell you very much at all. So this is the
same.
No, but if you only publish this in a paper, the viscosity is a function of shear rate. You don't know what's going on. It's just quite a boring system. But if you plot the stress, you can see there's something quite interesting happening. So
you mean the viscosity in some sense is a quantity that assumes a homogeneous system.
It's exactly.
Absolutely the wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's really important to, you know, if you're just doing something which you're weakly changing the properties, this is fine. But it's so hard to tell what's going on when you plot the viscosity. So,
what is the system?
I'm not going to say. The person who plotted that is not here, so. But at least they showed both of them. Right. Okay. How long should I go on? Yeah. Oh, okay, well, I won't go all the way to noon. Let me just do so look at Dave's system. So this is for one concentration. Now I can't remember, but I think depending on your valency, you can shift this thing either up or down with concentration. Right. Okay, so let's see what that would mean for the phase diagram. Okay. So we try to reconstruct possible candidate phase diagram. Okay, so one possibility is that when you reduce the concentration, the onset, okay, first of all, when you do the concentration, the zero shear viscosity should go down. So you expect this curve, the dotted line, to lie below the solid line when you reduce the concentration. Now, the possibility is either you induce the shear-induced phase at a lower stress and strain rate or at a higher stress and strain rate. Okay? So in this case, we know it's common stress because that's what the pictures tell us. So if we believe the pictures, then we know we've got to, let's see, how do I do this? I know that it's an increased concentration. The stress at which I induce the new phase has to increase. So I need this dotted line. This is the locus of coexistence points of between the quiescent phase and the two-phase region. So that line has to go up. Okay. Now I know that the and since that goes up, that must mean that the two-phase region is going to the left. Because I have to go from one state into another state. So that means already that the gel phase, if I believe this simple two-state picture, this means the gel phase has a lower concentration in the quiescent phase. Okay? And it means that the tie lines are such that the, so in this case, I certainly want to have a lower concentration, so the tie lines have to be sloped to the left, and they're going to be going down from a high shear rate to a low shear rate. So in this case, you might expect a set of tie lines in this plane which looks something like that. Now, Dave can tell me whether this is right or wrong, but I can't remember which system. Right.
I think it's right.
Right. So now the other possibility is if you, when you lower the concentration, if it induces the phase at a higher stress or a higher shear rate. So that means that this line, which separates the two-phase regions, they're sloping this way. Now it's going to be sloping this way. And that means that the gel phase, again, if we believe this two-phase picture, the gel phase has a higher concentration than the solvent phase. So that's already significant information by looking at the concentration dependence of the flow curves. Is really slippery.
Well, on the sigma phi plot, what you're saying is that you always have to enter the region when you first meet a timeline. And yes. Somehow, with the other plot, they get twisted over, and that's not true. And
that's
I don't
right.
quite see how.
And the
reconciled.
Yeah. So this is the field variable.
Yeah. Why couldn't I draw that picture with a solid red line and write it? As you know you can in the other representation.
Yeah. Yeah. Would that help, actually? Well, so that's exactly the point. Can one do that?
Yeah, so you say if you take a...
So I start at some concentration. And there's my coexistence point. Coexistence, what, that's one of the coexistence stresses. And so these two points demarcate one concentration and another concentration at that stress. Pardon?
Shut him up.
He did, yeah. No. I've worried about this, and I have no answer one way or the other. I just get completely confused if I try to put...
Yeah, but I was confused as soon as I saw your picture with the
other one the other way around.
When you go through the five-phase region, you nuclear the face on the far side, and you come back and zip through. And I can sort
Which
of
is this one
back.
Here.
Yeah, that's already happened then.
Yeah.
So somehow that's, at the moment, you're saying, or seem to be saying, that's possible with Ganadon, but not with Sigma. And I couldn't, reluctantly accepted that you can do it with Ganadon. know he's got to do a single
thing. Right. So this, let's see. Yeah. It's got to be in there.
No, the 3D is.
You don't like
that? I'm not sure I agree with that. I can't see anything particular about that service, which says it's more or less kind of that you can't exchange gamma dot and sigma and have a valid surface as well.
Yeah, you could do that and have a valid surface.
But I'm saying that for any material with a sigma, with that surface there, I can kind of invent a complementary material which gamma dot and sigma are interchanged, and it seems to me that somehow everything should kind of agree. But I actually don't believe what I've just said, but I can't see what's wrong with it at the moment.
What's it supposed to be? That's a strong statement.
Yeah.
But doesn't this also relate to the business about whether you cannot have his curve?
This is exactly related to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Francois's curve. So Francois believes that
it's the whichever you want to call it.
Gradient banding.
But
with a steady state. Yeah. Right. So that would suggest that you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. So, yep.
If you just point on the 3D diagram, point to the.
Right.
You've got the
fact
dash line
and
the thin constant line.
Fact dash line. Ah.
Both of those.
Right.
The issue of where they lie.
So, what happens is. You turn on the flow, and you come up to here. Sorry. You come up to there. Now, there's that stress connects these two phases. Now there'll be another stress somewhere else. But at this stress, a little bit higher up, which will connect two other points in the curve. Yes. So this is a higher stress, and it's connected two points with different strain rates and different concentration, different strain rates. And then what we're arguing about is the projection of these two points onto the stress concentration plane. Right. Now the issue is, can you construct a surface so that?
Sure.
Go for it. So. I have overhangs here.
We have to have overhangs which point in the other direction.
Yes, but I've done the construction in this case for common strain, right?
Yeah, but you just need to surface
coming.
Just overhang like that.
So that's exactly what this is.
No, that overhang just rotate
by 90 degrees. Rotate the surface by 90 degrees.
Rotate the surface by 90 degrees, and you must have it.
You need to go up in gamma dot and come back, fold over the other way. So.
Ah, yeah.
So you need an overhang along the fiber.
Right. So you would need.
Are all surfaces alive?
I'm sure.
Are there any rules about what surfaces you can use?
I think the surfaces must have the property that one of the surfaces, sigma goes to zero when gamma dot goes to zero. We imagine that we begin with a fluid. But if you begin with a.
I
don't think that's
just small.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can come up with a surface like that, I'd be very happy to see that.
Oh, actually,
it's a thought.
Yeah.
It's not a surface at the moment.
It's a thought.
You might not even have to have the constraint that it goes to zero, that the stress goes to zero, or gamma dot equals zero. I think I have an example.
No, you don't actually need that. I agree.
In the laboratory.
Yeah.
You can
Yeah. We could have another one. That's right. Yeah. In fact, you could so in the original flow curves I wrote down, the one. I mean, if you're coexisting between here and here. Yeah. But the issue is, when you turn on the flow, this is what your counterexample is going to be. If you begin with a fluid, you have to begin with something
right.
That
well,
one.
Well, I have an example where I begin with
a solid?
Here with the gel, and as soon as I turn on the flow, it ceases to be a gel, apparently.
Good. Yeah. So. But that's not this case. Anyway, yeah. No, I take Mike's point, yeah, and I don't know the answer. I thought I tried pretty hard, but no proof. So, okay.
Here, one question.
Yep.
Experimentally, how often do you see a selected stress, or how many counterexamples are there where no matter how hard people try, they can't see evidence for a selected stress in something that's shear bending? The simplest and strongest prediction you're making is just that, you know, because the velocity of the interface only vanishes at one stress, that there should be a selection rule, like as in thermodynamics.
There are, if you look at the mathematics, there are examples where there is no selected stress. And I'm sure that there are those kind of cases in experimental as well. It's in the case of differential equations where you're writing gradient terms, it's is there an existence? Can you tune the parameter to get solvability? And it's not obvious that there is.
I guess I'm just asking, can one characterize the experiments at this point? Are people overwhelmingly seeing a selected stress?
For the most part. Modulo the slow kinetics of getting to a selected stress.
I see the next
four
complications.
This is the simple.
This is
yeah.
Not complicated.
We haven't had any of those.
Yeah. Because the shear bending can be driven by normal stress differences as well. So it's not only the shear stress, but the normal pressure.
I think that's taken into account.
Stability can be
at the boundary.
Yeah, it could go unstable. Yeah. Okay, so of course there are many complications. A lot of them, okay, so many of them, when you look closer at the worm-like micelles, as we saw yesterday, and as we'll see on Monday, that it's not necessarily a simple two-band, at least in experiments. I'm going to put that here somewhere. And so this is some Paul Callahan and Elmar Fisher's, that they see this sort of thick pneumatic gel near the surface. And so that suggests that either, you know, one needs to think about three phases and what are the possible things that one can get for three phases, which seems to be the case. Or you know, there may be a possibility that this phase exists up here as an unstable steady state. And the system tries to coexist but then finds it can't. And this intervenes as a sort of halfway house. Another set of experiments, which Jean-Francois showed, was these from Sandro LaRouge's thesis work. I don't know how well this can be seen, but this is CTAB NA and O3. And when the flow is turned on, it starts to behave itself. Well, some dramatic things occur at the beginning, but then you start seeing a band and you think, well, that's fine, it's going to settle down. But then you go along and the band explodes. And down here, you've got a sort of a very striated band and then sort of the normal band, which suggests that something has gone wrong up here. You know, perhaps it tried to coexist with this band, then this is an unstable state. Or maybe the interface construction didn't work. There wasn't a velocity at which it was stable. And then it broke up and something happened. So this may be a counterexample to what you're saying, or it could be that there's a third phase hanging around here as well.
Well, it could also be a mechanical instability.
Yeah. What do you mean by mechanical instability?
Well, something that doesn't have to do with the existence of a third phase, but something that has to do with the fact that,
You mean an inertial instability?
Yeah. Well, it could be inertial or elastic.
What do you mean by elastic?
Viscoelastic.
He's got all of those models in general.
Viscoelasticity is in here. No.
Say for interface instabilities and so
there's no hydrodynamics in.
That's what I mean.
Then the inertial terms have been thrown away.
Well, it doesn't have to necessarily be inertial.
V dot grad V. Is that the one you mean?
Well, it could be elastic.
No. Well, that's in there. Anything that's in the constitutive relation for the stress is in there.
But are spatial variations, for example, just to take this, an interfacial instability, just like when you have two different viscosity liquids.
Right, no, what hasn't been done is to include these kinds of things.
So that's what I mean by mechanical instability.
But I don't call it mechanical, because mechanical is an overused word. And let me just... I'm going to say that quite clearly. I'm sick of it. Okay. No, I am.
What should I call it?
Interfacial instability, if that's what you mean. Because...
but there are different...
Exactly, right. So just think about instabilities.
Everybody
has their own thing. So I'm going to tell you my take on it. Okay, when you have a negative slope, this goes under various names, mechanical, constitutive, whatnot. I would be happy to call that mechanical, because what will happen is the rate of strain will increase unboundedly. So this is quite valid to call that mechanical instability, which is different from an interfacial instability, which is why I said, what do you mean by mechanical instability? It's often suggested that this kind of instability is different from an instability seen in phase transitions. But in fact, it's not. It's exactly the same.
No, I think of these as phase transition instabilities.
Good. Yeah.
As opposed to, say, wet instability, which
that's an inertial instability. Yeah.
We can have similar instabilities that are not driven by inertia, but are driven by viscoelastic.
Viscoelasticity is in here.
If you consider banded states with a flat interface, then you've imposed on that system a certain kind of spatial heterogeneity.
Right.
And absolutely.
Unstable to all sorts of
all other. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Not just necessarily the interface. In principle, it would be unstable to some mode where there's a concentration fluctuation.
Coming around, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And obviously, until you solve the whole thing exactly, you will never be able to do it.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
But I would also attempt to avoid the word mechanical and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Don't say mechanical.
Okay.
but the point is that this kind of negative slope is what you see in a phase transition,
uh-huh.
Right? And in fact, any phase transition has a spinodal point where it's unstable. The Volk modulus goes negative and... all hell breaks loose. So this is mechanical phase transition. It's all the same kind of thing. But the thing you can distinguish is between an instability where the effective constitutive behavior has a negative slope or where it doesn't. This is like what Mike was talking about yesterday. And so if it doesn't, it means that there's some other degree of freedom in the dynamics going unstable, which is not coupled very directly to the rate of strain. And so a simple idea, one might be another order parameter, either conserved or unconserved, which has a coefficient which goes negative. So concentration or some other unconserved order parameter, which isn't coupled very directly to the flow. Because in the Matic order parameter, when your coefficient in front goes negative, it'll actually couple directly to the flow and make the strain rate go negative. And so Carlos and Bronick Schmidt and Francois Lecoeur did some nice work working out how, depending on which kind of instability you have, that is, where the rate of strain is the direct object or the concentration, you can make statements about the wave vector of the instability that occurs. So, and those are the kind of things that Suzanne Feeling is working on at the moment as well. Right. Oh, the other thing, which is interesting, okay, this is too much, but the last thing, it's a bit about gradient banding and vorticity banding. This is related to this business about trying to construct a negative slope. This is from Paul's work with Melanie Britton. So these are the steady-state flow curves measured. And you can see you've got plateaus, but you've got other weird things happening as well. Now, Paul assured me, you can tell me if you still assure me, that these are steady-state measurements and reproducible.
Well, Melanie did them. I can only believe what she tells me they are. But,
yeah. Which I'm
just that you're drawing such profound conclusions.
But so I looked at these and I thought, well, if they really are, then that must mean there's some vorticity banding going on. Right. So we look in the Couette device. What do we see from Paul's picture? Conan plate. So if we look in the, this is done in Conan plate. So you look in the device and what do we see? Well, see here, for example, we've got this region up here, and where the vorticity axis is like that. We've got a region up here, which is different from the region down here. So it looks like we've got vorticity banding happening inside the Conan plate, but we've also got a little bit of gradient banding going on at the same time. And there's sort of a kink in here. Now, whether that's purely geometric or not, but it's consistent with the kinks in the flow curve. And in fact, if the upper branch does come down, you know, all the way down below, as in the liquid crystal case, there's no reason to expect that it's not allowed. That you could get both common stress and common strain rate occurring, why not at the same time? This one looks like it's almost pure vorticity banding rather than gradient.
Are there secondary flows in these things?
Oh, undoubtedly.
Probably there are, yeah.
Well, we tried to measure them, and certainly within the precision we had, we didn't see that, and that's... So in other words, the velocities of any secondary flow would be an order of a few percent less than the main velocities that we see. So if you put an upper limit on secondary flow, we might see maybe some
Secondary flows are a definite candidate for this as well.
Yeah. And I mean, the problem here is you've got a meniscus on the outside, you've got an edge on the outside, and so God knows what's going on out there.
Yeah.
I mean, can you say too much about flow close to that outside edge? Yeah.
There has been some recent work by Ron Larson looking at the secondary instability that can occur in a banded flow in the Conan plate. And I don't remember, I don't know if you know, Gary, the results. Is it?
Well, it's because we've got a lot of grease.
Yeah.
The Couette is bad for other reasons, maybe it doesn't have uniform stress.
Right.
So you have to, I think, basically.
Decide which is your poison.
You make a less real plan for it, no? Just no cheese. It's more fan ground than cylinder.
I mean, this phenomenon can be banned when it comes to the top on the outside here. That's quite, I mean, that's seen a lot. That's seen in other systems as well.
To the cone.
To the top of the cone.
Yeah.
I mean, migrating into the middle as you get closer to the apex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I guess I'll summarize. So, in simple banding, that is, we just have two states, and we're just looking at time-dependent states where everything is stable. We have some idea of how flow curves relate to the phase diagram. One important point is how the concentration difference between the two phases affects the slope on the plateau. You need a selection criteria of some sort if you want to theoretically describe it, you know, either from PDEs, partial differential equations, or something to do with the Sharpe interface, if that's the way it is. If Mike can't construct his surface, then a negative slope implies vorticity banding, and a slope coming that way implies gradient banding, but something sort of up in that, the quadrant, positive x, positive y, is ambiguous, and you have to look. Of course, there are many more complex systems that one can imagine. One thing is there are very few experiments looking at vorticity banding in detail, although it has been seen. It would be very nice to get some systematic experiments to see about the length scale of the bands, how they course, and whether it's truly a stable state. And of course, there's lots of kinetics. So I'll stop there.